Hey guys, I'm Joelle.
And I'm Peg Arad.
And I'm so excited because we have a great guest here for you today. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
Welcome guys to the Knife Hour. Today is a huge, splendid, awesome day because today we have Tony Richmond in the studio with us. And I'm so excited. If you guys are unfamiliar, you need to get familiar. Tony Richmond has been making movies since the 60s. He's had a diverse career, as you're likely to find. His work includes David Bowie's The Man Who Fell to Earth, the Rolling Stones documentary Sympathy for the Devil, Legally Blonde, The Sandlot, Men of Honor, Sean Penn's directorial debut The Indian Runner, John Tucker Must Die, Candyman, and the 70s classic Don't Look Now. Please join us in welcoming Cinematography Chair of NYFA Los Angeles, Tony Richmond.
Yay! Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today.
Not at all.
We always start with the same question because I find it a really good place to start for people. And that question is, when did you fall in love with film?
Oh, when I was a very young kid. My dad, who was a taxi driver, loved two things in life, football or soccer and the movies. We went to the movies twice a week, and I fell madly in love with the movies. And I'd see any sort of movie that was possible, you know. I mean, there were, and in those days you saw two movies. I mean, a B movie and an A movie, or the feature movie. And it was great. So I fell madly in love with the movies and decided that somehow that is what I wanted to do. I mean, I didn't have any knowledge of how to make movies. I didn't have any. I didn't know anybody in the movie business. And I left school when I was 15, which you could in those days legally, because then after 15 in England, you went to higher education. And I managed to get a job at Pathé News as a runner, running up and down Wardour Street with cans of film. And I thought I was in the movie business. So that was the start of it.
Were there any particular filmmakers that inspired you to...
I fell in love with cinematography or the photography of movies basically from watching the movie Shane.
Okay.
It was a fantastic visual movie, and I just loved that movie. I mean, very slow by today's standards, but it's a stunning movie. And then, you know, after Pathé News, I left there after a couple of years, and then I managed to get onto some movies. I went to a studio called Danziger Brothers, which... was a small studio in Boreham Wood near Associated British Cinemas, where all the big studios were in MGM. And there were two Americans who actually owned the Mayfair Casino, which is a legitimate casino, but I'm sure they were probably laundering money somehow. I managed to get onto the feature unit, and we shot one feature every 7 days. I mean, they're absolute total rubbish.
Wow.
They were the B features, but it was a great learning experience. I mean, you know, just as a young assistant cameraman, just a great learning experience.
Wow.
But you assisted on, like, some really big films.
I was lucky, yes. I guess the first really big film I did was From Russia with Love, the James Bond picture, the second James Bond picture. I was lucky to get on that. Someone was ill, and I took over for a couple of days, and then just stayed on. You know, it was one of those, just really a lucky break. And then after that, I managed to... do a couple of other movies. I then joined Hammer Studios and did some of those great Hammer horrors. Did four of those Hammer horrors as an assistant cameraman with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. And everybody was permanently employed at the Hammer Studios except for the cinematographers. They would come in. And one of these cinematographers, John Wilcox, who took me under his wing, he then took me to Israel on a huge movie called Judith with Peter Finch and Sophie Loren. So we were in Israel for about 8 months.
Wow.
And that's where I met Nicholas Roeg. And then he, you know, I hung out with his crew. He was shooting the second unit, but his crew were really a lot of fun. And much younger than the crew, so I hung with them. And then we became very friendly. He was more like a father figure to me. But, you know, he said, listen, I'm leaving. He left a couple of months early, and he said, I'm going to do a movie. I can't take my regular crew, but I'm sure going to take you. And I can't tell you what it was. And when I got back from Israel to London, it turned out to be Dr. Zhivago.
Oh, wow.
And that
amazing.
Was the start of everything grand happening to me there. You know, it was just one. I was in the right place at the right time.
How old were you when all of this was happening?
I mean, I was 18, 19, 20.
Wow.
That's so cool.
And then I think I was 20 on Zhivago, yeah.
Wow. So
and we were on it for 52 weeks.
Were you with Nicholas Rowe? Because I know a lot of people, that's kind of their introduction to you is through his work. And I'm curious, was that mentorship just, you know, he was a older, cooler guy who knew what he was doing, or...
He was a young cinematographer, and he, you know, so I went on... David Lean had insisted having the operator on focus while he had Lawrence and Arabia. So I went on as a second assistant cameraman, or clapper load, as we call it in those days. Now they're called second assistants. And unfortunately, Nick got fired after a month. And then Freddie Young took over. In those days, you know, if you were part of a camera crew, if the DP left or fired or got whatever, you went with him. So I was going to leave with Nick. And he said, no, you've got to stay on. It would be good for your career. And I very begrudgingly stayed on. And David Lean sort of knew that I didn't like him because he'd fired Nick. But he went out of his way and really took me under his wing. And I just learned so much from that man. You know, I mean, he's a brilliant, brilliant director. And then at the end of... it's all weird, a lot of weird happenings. At the end of Dr. Zhivago, after the 52 weeks of shooting, I was driving around Madrid... and then there was a hooter behind me. Beep, beep, beep. And I looked around, it was Nick Rowe. He said, follow me. So I followed him, and it's straight to the apartment, in the apartment building where I had an apartment, and he was in the same one, and he was just about to start a movie called A Funny Thing Happened All the Way to the Forum.
Oh.
And that was so I went on that with him, and that was fantastic. That was with all the greats, Jack Guilford, Zero Mostel, Phil Silvers, Buster Keaton. I think that movie killed Buster Keaton, because in every shot he was running around the Seven Hills of Rome. He never stopped running.
Oh my goodness.
He died just after that, which is terribly sad.
No.
But anyway, so I was on that, and then after that we came back and did Fahrenheit 451, which again was with Julie Christie.
And Francois Truffaut, right?
Pun?
And Francois?
And Francois Truffaut, yes. Yeah, absolutely fantastic Truffaut, absolutely fantastic. And then I started pulling focus towards the end of that. And then after Fahrenheit 451, we went on to Casino Royale, but the one with Woody Allen,
right.
Playing 007. And with all the, you know, Peter Sellers and everybody was in that movie. It was absolutely crazy, just dreadful, but it was such a lot of fun to do. And then after that, I pulled focus on Far From the Madding Crowd, which Nick was the DP on, and so at the end of Far From the Madding Crowd, Nick came back to America, or not came back, went to America to shoot a picture of Dick Lester. And I obviously couldn't do it because of the American unions, and why would they take a focus pull? Yeah. So in those days, you know, as I say, if the DP didn't work, you didn't work, so that's going to be out of work. But then John Schlesinger liked me, and he was a brilliant director, and we became very friendly, John and I. And I particularly liked him because he owned one of the better restaurants in London in Covent Garden. So I used to go there with him and his boyfriend and have these wonderfully great free dinners and lunches. And then the six-day war in Israel started in June 67. And he asked me to go and shoot a documentary for him. So I went out 2 days after the war with John, and Wolf Mankiewicz, a writer, and we shot some incredible footage of the aftermath of that six-day war. And, you know, once again, it was being in the right place at the right time. And we came back, and I certainly didn't want to be a documentary cinematographer, so I thought I'd wait for Nick. You know, I didn't know what I was going to do. Because although there was television in England, in those days, all television stations had their own, like the BBC had its own crew. There were no freelancers. It was only the movie business that was freelance. And John had a friend, a very... old, a wonderful British director called Basil Dearden, who made some amazing movies. And John said, you know, he was about to start a new movie, and he said, you should use Tony, he's a great new cinematographer. And I got a call one night from Basil Dearden, where I was living, and looking after Nick Rogue's flat whilst he was in America. And Basil came on and introduced himself, and I introduced myself, and he said, look, I'm just about to start this movie. It's with David Hemmings, and we're going to start in New York, we're going to shoot in Lebanon and London, and I'd like you to do it. I thought he was asking me to be the camera operator.
Oh.
And I said, no, who's going to be the DP or cameraman? I said, well, you. And I said, no, who's going to be the lighting cameraman, as we were called in those days? And he said, you. And I said, oh. And he said, you want to do it? And I said, well, I'd like to, but I've never done that before. He said, would you want to have a go? And I said, yes. And that was, the rest is history. And then after that movie, a couple of extraordinary things happened. I mean, when the movie was over, they in those days, they would sometimes bring in a title company to do the main titles. And they hired this company called Chambers and Partners, which also made television commercials. And they were pushing a very young director to do some commercials, and he was going to direct the titles. And they thought it would be good, as it was with the actors, the cinematographer who shot the movie shot the titles. And it turned out to be Michael Lindsay Hogg. And we became great buddies after the 4 days of shooting. And he said, what are you doing next weekend? I said, well, nothing. He said, do you want to come and shoot Jumping Jack Flash with the Rolling Stones? And that started all that, you know. And then Michael and I became great buddies, and I did the Rock and Roll Circus with him, and the Beatles Let It Be with him, you know. So that was that.
So you've just described a ginormous body of work.
And then one more rock and roll thing I did.
Yes,
was the Who's The Kids Are All Right, the compilation movie. I did a lot of the live action for that. And I thought that all took place in sort of 68, early 69. And I thought, you know, I didn't want to do any more rock and roll because I didn't think I could ever beat those three groups, the Stones, mm-hmm. the Beatles, and the Who. So,
yeah. Huge body of work, like you were saying, by just right place at the right time, as well as being prepared and being willing to take on.
I mean, you have to have a lot of luck in this business because there's so many people out there that really have the credentials, have the talent, both in actors, actresses, cinematographers, directors, but just you need that little bit of luck. But I mean, you'll get it if you pursue, if you persevere. Sure. You've got to keep persevering and trying and trying and trying.
You have to be out there.
And as a cinematographer, just keep shooting. Shoot anything. Shoot, because you'll always learn. You'll always learn. Right. You know?
Well, okay, so at first you were open to taking all of these projects, anything that came your way. Further down the line, when you had gotten a name for yourself, we see that your choices are still very diverse, from Candyman to Legally Blonde to The Sandlot. Is your approach to these films different, and if so, how?
Well, the approach is different, but I mean, it's just if I like the script, really. I mean, it's been different in the last 5 years because there's not the massive amount of work there used to be where you'd get offered two or three movies and you could choose the movie you wanted to do. I mean, it doesn't happen anymore. It's you do what you're offered sort of thing, really. But in the early days, it was if I liked the script, and I don't think that... you know, I like everything. I like comedy. I love comedy. I like drama. I like it all. But I mean, I like kids' movies. There's nothing wrong. I think kids' movies are great, except most of them are dreadful. I mean, they've got to be good for the parents too. And that's what really I loved about The Sandlot, because kids loved it, but parents absolutely loved it because it reminded them of their youth. And that movie still holds up today because...
Oh, absolutely.
I just saw an outdoor screening of it recently.
Yeah.
It's timeless. It's timeless. As long as kids are frightened of dogs and they play Little League, it's going to be... It's wonderful.
Right.
But I mean, so you've got to have... And also, as a cinematographer, the only thing that matters really is the story. We're a slave to the story. And the cinematographer's job, he or she, is to put the director's vision on the screen and hopefully take that vision a little further and make it even better.
I wanted to ask you, as I said earlier, you did Sean Penn's Indian Run, which was his directorial debut.
Right.
At that point, you're kind of a seasoned vet. Did you feel any additional responsibility to helping him along? Or how do you approach working with a first-time director? Is it different?
Well, you know, it just depends. I mean, I've worked with a lot of first-time directors. I have to say, for me, the best ones have all been actors because they really know how to handle actors. I mean, I shot Sean's first movie, Angelica Houston's first movie, Tony Goldwyn's first movie, all great movies. But, I mean, you know, there's a lot of the younger directors come from either colleges or film schools, commercials, rock videos, and all have wonderful eyes, and a great visual sense. But sometimes they're a little intimidated by actors. And actors can be intimidating because they sort of speak a different language to us, you know. And every actor needs directing. I mean, basically because the director is a mirror to the actor, you know, to keep them on the straight level. So they for me, are being the best, you know. And, you know, both with that, all of them. I mean, and I got on fabulously with all those three directors. I've never actually had a bad time with a director. I've been very lucky because you hear horror stories, but I've had wonderful time. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, do you attribute that to your approach? Are you, because you're more your biggest concern is the vision, do you think maybe that helps? Because I've heard from directors, horror stories of DPs who, you know, are like, the shot has to be this way, and it...
Well, there's a lot of DPs. Like, that's ridiculous, because you work for the director. And I mean, you know, sometimes with a younger or a newer director or a director that's come from another medium, I might feel there's a better way of doing it, or the shot would be better if he moved over here. But it's very important that you just take him, he or she, around the corner and whisper in there, what about this if we did it this way? Because you can't let the crew know that's going on, because there can only be one captain of the ship, and that is the director. And you've got to support him. And then if the director says, oh, well, that's a wonderful idea, we'll do that, yeah. Or if he or she says, that's not so, no, I don't want to do that, then that's the end of it. You don't keep harping, well, it would be better if we were over here. You know? But that's me. I mean, everybody's different. I mean, I've worked with directors who've had horrendous times with DPs on their last picture. Horrendous times.
Can you remember a scene maybe a scene that you had a challenge making and then you were really satisfied at the end with?
Oh, God. there's...
it was a major pain.
Strangely enough, on the last movie I shot, really? The last Wimpy Kid movie, yeah, we had a... Do you know what a spinning jenny is?
No.
Well, it's a ride. In England, we used to call it the rotor. It's a circular ride. You go in, and the rotor, this thing would spin, and the floor fell away.
You can't pull yourself.
That's
up.
Right, and you can't. It's spinning so fast.
Yes.
The centrifugal force keeps you back against the wall. So, we had this scene, in the last movie. So, whilst we were in Atlanta and prepping, a major fair was coming to near where we were shooting. We were going to shoot there for a week. But someone had one of these spinning jennies in the middle of nowhere in Atlanta. So we went off and we saw it. And it was horrible. I mean, the ride was horrible. I mean, it just... anyway, and it had like a, you know, a big sort of... it's open at the top, but it had a silk, white silk. And we said, well, you know, because there's no way... if you're inside, it doesn't look like it's spinning, especially if you're in the center where the driver is, because there's no centrifugal force there. And you know, we'd have to find a way of doing this. So I said, well, take that silk off, we can get a technocrane and come in and go high, and we see it spinning. Great. So then we found out later that you couldn't take that silk off because. Okay. The reason, just in case anybody flies out, it keeps them in there. It's a major panic set in. What are you talking about? So then we contacted the people who owned it with the fair we were using, and they said they would take it off. We had this heavy net made up. So we had this net made up, and we did the shot with the technocrane, which is fine because you see it spinning from the top because it's open. But there was no way we could... And then we went inside... And as it was beginning to spin, we did a little bit of the scene with the kids getting in position and getting faster. Then we had to stop it spinning. So how are we going to shoot that? So then I worked out with my gaffer, and a fabulous gaffer on it, Russ Ingalls. I've done 6 movies. He's just the best guy I've ever worked with. And I mean, he's an old-timer like me, too. And we put 4 60-foot condors up with... HMI, heavy HMI powers coming in, like sort of HMI spots. And they would come down, and I got some rock and roll lights, and they were constantly moving, and the powers were moving, so the thing was stationary, but we moved the lights through, so it looked like the sunlight going through, and it worked. You don't know it's not moving. I was very proud of that.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah. All without visual effects.
What was your gaffer's reaction to
It was great. It was wonderful. You know, I came up with the rock and roll lights, and he said, well, put some powers in there too, because they're very, very powerful. Mm. And then as they swung through the net that was on, you saw shadows, so it really looked like it was moving.
Oh, wow. My gosh.
That's amazing.
Brilliant.
Do you want to take the next question? Everybody.
No, go for it.
Okay, so we have Bart Mastrodoni in the studio, who is a horror filmmaker, and he described his love of horror beginning when he saw Friday the 13th when he was 9. And I was wondering, you've done a lot of horror, and some of your best work is considered from the horror genre. When did you fall in love with horror?
I've always liked horror.
Yeah?
Yeah, I remember seeing as a kid, I was petrified. I saw The House of Wax. That frightened the life out of me. Yeah. That really frightened the life out of me. I climbed in the cinema window because I couldn't afford to go in. the window at the back, my mates and I used to climb in, just in North London. And I was petrified. I didn't sleep for days after that, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
And Peeping Tom was another one.
Peeping Tom.
Okay. I want to talk about Don't Look Now. The opening scene, which I just saw for the first time a couple of weeks ago, my friend sat me down, showed it to me. He was like, you have to see this. It's amazing. It is perhaps one of the most frightening scenes in cinematic history. It's mostly built upon suspense, which I like a lot.
Right.
And I wonder, going into it, is that something that you guys storyboarded? Were you 100% positive what you were going for? Or
no, Nick Rogue, we didn't storyboard or do shot lists or anything.
Ever?
Nick is not. No, never. Not that. I've never worked on many movies where we've done shot lists, actually, or storyboards.
Wow.
You always storyboard an action sequence, because that's very important.
Sure.
No. I mean, everybody has a different way of working. Like, you have to teach shot lists in film school, because it's very important to get the student into that, you know. I like to work with directors that when we start a new scene, you know, they come onto the set with just him and I and the actors and maybe the script or the script girl or, you know, continuity sitting in the corner. Let the director wander around for 5-10 minutes with the actors and sort of talk about it and this, and then we'll start to block it. And then we'll block the scene and then write the shot list then, as opposed to doing it weeks beforehand, you know.
Wow. So with a scene that's so emotionally intense and essentially and actually setting up the story, how did you go into it for Don't Look Now?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, Nick Rogue, that particular, he's a very organic director, and he, you know, if you, you know, he wants actors to bring something to the story. And we struck very lucky. We found this beautiful farm with a pond. It was idyllic, you know, just outside London. And we did that, we shot that in 4 days, all the London stuff in 4 days. And it was, the weather was incredible. It was a beautiful sunny, all the days there were beautifully sunny, but the sun at that time is very, very low, so it's always backlit and just stunning. And you know, it was cold, so it had that crispness to it. The hardest part was, it was very emotional to shoot with that little girl, because you know, I went into the water with Donald in a wetsuit. It was so cold with a little Ariflex 2C, and he comes running into the water and goes under. And then, you know, we'd had the actress who you just see running around with a doll and the little red jacket. But then came the point where Donald brings the kid up. And we did that it's on the farm, and we found a metal tank. That's why it's a little bit dark, because we filled it full of water. And the little girl went under and brought it up. But it was really, it was sort of terrifying, sort of, you know, hearing Nick say, well, you know, you've got to pretend you're dead. And it just, but it worked beautifully. But it was a very, very emotional scene. It was very tough.
Wow.
Very tough scene.
Is there a film that you've seen that you wish you would have shot?
Oh, lots of them.
Give me some examples.
Oh, my God. I mean, I wish I'd have shot... I don't know. I mean, just so many of them. I don't know. It's just a lot. I don't have any. I mean, I think I don't ever necessarily have any favorite movies. I've got favorite movies. My favorite movie of all time is Alphaville. Jean-Luc Godard's Alphaville. I just love that movie.
I've never seen this.
Oh, it's a fantastic movie. Absolutely fantastic.
I have to check it out. What's it about?
Almost science fiction movie. It's just fantastic. And Eddie Constantine's in it, remade his career. It's a wonderful movie. Love Alphaville.
Let's check that out.
It's very old, but I think it made it about 1960. I don't know, maybe early, mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I shot a movie for Godard, which was wonderful, too. After Alphaville, was one of my favourites. He's made some amazing movies, you know, Breathless, mm-hmm. you know, Band Apart. but I shot a movie for Godard with the Rolling Stones and the British version of the Black Panthers, which is really weird. And it got just slated. But, you know, it's had a resurgence because this last summer they did a 4K restoration of that from the original negative. And I was over there just before Christmas doing the final colour correction. And now critics are saying it's not probably the complete piece of garbage they thought it was. And they're seeing more into it, you know.
That's actually an interesting point. So you just said they brought you back in. So is that what they do, is when they're remaking something or revamping it?
Well, if they can get all the cinematography. Sure. When it's restorations, it's hard because their budgets are so small. You know, but usually for DVDs, when we do a colour correction of a movie, I will do a pass, you know, obviously pass of the digital cinema packs, and then do another pass of the Blu-ray. And the DP will always be there for that, you know. But when they remaster something, but I've got pretty good relationships with those people, so they you didn't get paid for it. They gave me an air ticket, but it was nice to go to London twice. So.
Nice.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your approach, just from an artistic perspective. Grace Coddington, who's an editor for Vogue, is like one of my idols, and she has this theory that if you are a photographer of any kind, you can never close your eyes. She's like, because you'll miss inspiration. It's everywhere. And so that's kind of her approach. And I was wondering what inspires
right.
you.
She's absolutely right. I mean, everything, life inspires me, you know. And it's all changing now. It's so different, you know. Everything is so different. Everything is sort of easier but harder. I mean, and I say that doesn't make any sense, but I say that because it's, you know, the cameras, the digital cameras are so fast now. You know, they're very easy to use, very simple to use, and it's also harder because sometimes, you know, you've got to get rid of the natural light, you know, to make it what you want. I mean, a lot of the low budget films just shoot with natural light because that's has to be that way because of money. But sometimes you don't want all that natural light. You want to control it. You want to, you know, you're as a cinematographer dictating what the audience will see in that frame.
When's the last time you shot on film?
Last time I shot on film was a couple of it was a few years ago. I shot the third Wimpy Kid on film.
Okay. Do you have a preference?
I like digital. I mean, I do like. I mean, film is better, but I tell you what, I like it because, you know, we used to, before digital intermediates came in, that is where you shoot on film and they scanned it into a computer and they cut and did everything on the computer and color corrected and then you made a new negative. Before digital intermediates came in, everything was a photochemical process. You know, you shot on film. You printed the negative, you saw the dailies, and the dailies you saw the next day at lunch, or if you're in a studio, or you go to a screening room in the evening, and you actually saw what you were doing. Once we got into the digital intermediates, dailies suddenly started to appear on really horribly compressed DVDs, and you didn't see anything. And then sometimes they would put them up online, you know. So when it went full digital, I loved it because I got two fantastic monitors, even though it's in a different colour space, it's in Rec 709. You know, it was absolutely fantastic. You can judge things on that, you know, and then you've got a DIT with you, so you're colour correcting as you go. It's wonderful, so I rather like that, you know.
Is it the expedience of it that you like, or is it just knowing for sure? Because I know a lot of times when you're watching your dailies, you're like, we've got to reschedule another day to go back and shoot these things. But with digital, it's kind of more immediate. You can maybe make adjustments.
Can make some. I mean, all you're doing, the only adjustments you're making when you're shooting is it's not baked in. It's only metadata. So I'm color correcting as I go with the DIT. And that metadata just goes to whoever's going to do the dailies, because they've still got to do dailies. Mm. And they'll make it look like we made it. But also, it's a starting point for when you do your DI, but it's not burnt in. You know, studios wouldn't like that. They'd hate that if it's burnt in.
I'm wondering how you feel about, especially some of your, you know, maybe your more prized work. Do you have a preference for screens? I know some people are like, please don't watch my movies on a phone. Like, that's not how they were shot for. It's not the right medium.
We shouldn't watch movies on a phone. I mean, go to the cinema. Movies go to the cinema, you know, television. I mean, you know, I mean, I watch DVDs on television, but I mean, if I want to movies, I go to the cinema. Love the cinema.
Martin Scorsese recently wrote an article proclaiming it was the theater was dying, that the cinema was dying.
I think it is. Yeah. I mean, I think it is. I mean, you know, I mean, you can get anything on TV now. People are just, it's, you know, cinemas are very expensive, really. I mean, if you go out and you can, take your wife and a couple of kids and, you know, and some popcorn and some sodas. I mean, it's more expensive than going to Wolfgang Puck's.
Right.
I mean, it really is. And everything is online. So, I mean, I just went out and bought myself a 65-inch OLED television for about 4,000 quid.
Oh, wow.
But it's fantastic. It's like being in the cinema. It's lovely. But still, the cinema is the best thing, you know.
Can you feel when a movie that you're working on is going to be a hit?
That's hard to say. I mean, I think you got to think it's going to be good. Mm-hmm. But who knows when it's going to be a hit? I mean, it should be. I mean, I've worked on so many movies. It all start off to be fantastic. And something along the line goes wrong and they turn out to be stinkers, you know.
Oh.
But I knew we had something special with The Man Who Fell to Earth. And also with Don't Look Now. You know, those were special movies, you know. But there's been so many. I mean, and most of them have done pretty well, you know.
I think...
is a hit? I mean, is it a hit because it makes a lot of money or because it gets good reviews or because it's, you know... I mean, I'd like to reshoot every single shot I've ever done except for one.
And which shot is that?
Well, it's a close-up of Julie Christie in Don't Look Now, where we were doing, towards the end, we were doing the sequence where she's in the barge going across the Grand Canal with the coffin and the two sisters. And we had three or four cameras set up on the Grand Canal, and it was a very sort of sunny but misty day. And at the last minute, Nick said, quick, get the Arri-2, jump in the boat with Julie and cover yourself up and do a shot up of her like that. So I got in the boat and lens on the two-seat Arri. And she had a black hat and a black jacket or a coat, very red lips and dark eyeshadow. And I got to meet her out. And we were in a side alley, you know, so there's no dark at all. So it was so dark. So I just opened up the lens as far as I could and shot it. And we came out and the shot was great and everything else was great. And as would happen in those days when you shot on film, you would call the labs the next morning and talk to the grader who did the nighttime grader. We'd call him at 6-7 o'clock in the morning. And we called Rome and I said, you know, how's it? Because our stuff was being processed in Rome. I said, how is it? He said, oh, it's all great, you know, in his Italian accent. He said, everything's beautiful, the Grand Canal and all. He said, but you can't use the close up of Julie Christie. I said, well, it's so overexposed. We can't bring it down. It's useless. I said, it doesn't matter. Well, when we saw it, it was fantastic because it was so overexposed. Because she was in black, the blacks were there, the red lips were there, and her dark eyeshadow and her eyes were there, and the skin became totally alabaster. It was fantastic. Perfect for the scene. Now, I have to say, I wouldn't have shot it that way. I mean, I don't know why. It would never have occurred to me. But that's the one shot I wouldn't want to do again. Because everything else you can do a little bit better.
It's a happy accident.
Yeah, wonderful accident. Yeah, there's
some great accidents in movie making.
Absolutely. I was wondering, do you think of The Man Who Fell to Earth as a surrealist film?
Yeah, I guess so. Probably now, yeah. I mean, it was way, way ahead of its time when that came out. I mean, and it got butchered here in America.
Did it?
I think it was Company 5 that distributed it. They held it up for like 4 years. They absolutely butchered the movie. And it never really came to true light here until the DVD came out with the director's cut, you know.
Yeah.
But now everybody loves the movie. They're seeing things in it that, you know, because, I mean, it's really, it sort of foreshadowed a lot of what's happening in major countries around. The corporations are running the country. That's about a corporation that gets out of control that the government couldn't handle, you know. I mean, it's one of the premises, you know.
What was it like working with Bowie?
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
He, I can't imagine anybody else playing that role. I mean, he was absolutely perfect. He'd just come off of, I mean, the original, Nick originally wanted Michael Crichton, the author.
Oh, okay.
To play that, who was, I don't think he'd ever acted, but he was very tall and very, very skinny and sort of looked sort of weird, unworldly, and, you know, but he said he would do it, then he didn't. And then Nick had seen a sort of documentary about Bowie. What was it called? Cracked Pop Star or Cracked Something. I forget what it's called. Mm. Or Cracked Actor. And Bowie was on a massive drug addiction, alcohol, everything. And he was just coming off of that. So Nick offered him the part, he accepted. So when he came there, And he was just about holding it together.
Wow.
And Nick didn't really direct him that much. He directed all the others because Bowie, he sort of left, in many cases, Bowie to his own resources to sort of get through. And he sort of glided through that movie in a very, very fragile state, which was fantastic. And Nick was clever enough and brilliant enough to see that, you know, and let that go.
I've heard some cinematographers say that they have close relationships with the actors, whereas the director is directing the actor, the cinematographer is usually the one right in the actor's face. Do you find that to be true? Do you interact with the actors at all?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them will still remain great friends, you know. Unfortunately, the ones I've, well, three of the closest were just, you know, passed on, you know, but... But I mean, I've had a great relationship with actors. I mean, that's very important, you know. I mean, I think that, you know, because especially nowadays, because directors are generally in another room or somewhere away from the camera. I mean, which is very bizarre to me. I mean, even though we're digital, I like to work with directors who are right by the camera, not looking through a monitor 10, 20 feet away. Actors like that. Actors like the director to be there. I mean, in the old days, when we were shooting on BNCs, you know, or film, before there were reflex cameras, I mean, you know, the actor, the director would be peering over the operator's shoulder, looking through the parallax viewfinder, and the script girl would be right under the camera, and everybody was right there, and, you know, it's fantastic. But, I mean, to be, some directors are in other rooms, which is pretty bizarre, sending notes in via radio to the AD to tell the actors. Actors hate that.
Oh, my goodness. That sounds very impersonal.
Well, it is. It's very impersonal, but, I mean... So, you know, when I work with Peter Maddock a lot, you know, he and David Bowers, too, this last director I work with, I mean, they have little handheld monitors, and but they're right by the camera looking at the monitor, you know.
After all these years in this industry, what is it that still excites you?
Well, I just love it. It's not... I think that... it's the only time I'm really happy with actually a movie. I'm sort of, I shouldn't say that, but I mean... But, I mean, it's just, it's a very exciting job. And it's not a job, actually. It's a way of life. I mean, it's all I've ever done. I've worked on movies. I've never done anything else, you know, other than a year of running around London with cans of film. And it's wonderful. And the great thing is when you travel, you go abroad. I mean, it's not like going on vacation for 2 weeks. You're there for months and months and months, and you work with local crews, you know. I mean, I shot one movie where were we? We were in Prague and Slovakia and Mexico with a whole Czech crew. It was fantastic. No one spoke any English. It was wonderful. Wonderful. And the wonderful crews. You get to know people. You get to know the culture and the way people live. It's great. It's been a great business. I've been very lucky.
That sounds wonderful. I'm curious, after having such a long career, what brings you to teaching?
Well, I mean, I guess really it's a sort of... Listen, I was helped so much as a young man. I was taken under the wings by directors, certainly by Nick Rogue. The three major cinematographers that really took care of me were Nicholas Rogue, John Wilcox, who was a brilliant cinematographer, absolutely brilliant. But, I mean, he never got his just dues, you know. And Freddie Young, obviously from Chicago, and John Schlesinger as a director... and they all helped me and pushed me and gave me great guidance. And I couldn't have done anything I've done without that help. So, you know, teaching is really like giving back, you know. Because one of the things is that, you know, we can help them when you've had a long career. You know, one of the things that's very sort of, in many ways, very hard to teach is actually what it's like on a movie set, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really hard. I mean, because when... The students are doing their practicums or their workshops. They're with a crew of 8 or 9 or 10, if they're lucky, you know, or 12. And then suddenly you get thrown onto a movie set with a small crew of 130, you know. And that's why I was so happy to have taken Jeremy Harris with me to Atlanta.
Jeremy Harris was a student of yours at NAIFA?
He was, but he was an alum. I couldn't take a student, but I took an alum.
Oh, gotcha.
And I got him... You know, he got a rather grand title of the assistant to the director of photography, and I got him paid on the production. Couldn't, you know, and he just learned a great deal. I had him watching, going with the riggers, with the rigging grips, with the rigging electricians. I had him out in second unit, had him out in the stunt unit. So it was a whole, you know, and those are things that are hard to teach. So anytime I do a movie, I'll always take a student with me.
that's so cool. And then I guess we just have one more question for you. And that is, what do you hope your legacy to film is?
Oh, God.
I like to end on a light note.
I don't think I'm going to leave a legacy here. I mean, just I'll carry on shooting up there. Or down there, wherever I go.
I love that.
I take a camera amazing. With me in the coffin.
Oh, my goodness.
I know that the Cinematique is doing a review of some of your movies called Do Look Now?
Don't Look... What?
I think... I'm trying to find the title. I just had it.
I think it's Tony Richard in Person or something like that.
Okay. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think that came about with The Man Who Fell to Earth being released in this country. And the American cinematographer asked if they could show it, and then they decided when they, I guess, looked at some of the other stuff I did, they wanted to do a sort of tribute, which is wonderful. I feel very proud of that. I'm very lucky. So they're going to do The Man Who Fell to Earth on Friday the 10th of February, and I'll do a Q&A afterwards. And then on Saturday they're going to do Don't Look Now, and then Candyman. I'll do a Q&A in between.
Nice. What a great double feature.
Yeah, oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of people get very scared by Don't Look Now, because there's such a great deal of realism about that. I mean, some people call it a psychological horror. I would be more inclined to call it a psychological thriller.
Okay, yeah,
those
definitely.
Those are the best.
Yeah. It is a haunting film that kind of does not leave you immediately. It's definitely one of those that follows you around afterwards.
And also... considering it was shot in 1972, it really holds up. I mean, it's sort of a universal story.
I mean, Antichrist, and watching it afterwards, you can see a lot of inspiration taken from Don't Look Now. So if you guys want to check out those screenings, which I strongly encourage you to do, they're amazing films, and then you could hear from the man himself and maybe ask him some questions yourself. You can go to Aero Theaters. It's at 1328 Montana Avenue in Santa Monica. I'm sure tickets are available online.
They are. $12. Yes.
Look at that. Where are you getting $12, guys? Amazing. Tony, thank you so much
for coming in.
This was wonderful. I really appreciate it. Come back next week. We're going to have Twinkie Bird, who is casting executive extraordinaire. She's wonderful, and she's also going to tell you guys about her new short film and her trip to Cannes. So we'll see you guys back here next week at the Knife Hour. Thanks.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.